Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
What are the differences between a winning and losing performance? Why are we able to rise to the challenge one day but wilt from it the next? Can we in fact become better competitors? In the new book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, New York Times bestselling authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman tackle a subject that we face, all of us, every day, in the office, in school, on the playing field, at home, revealing how to tip the odds of success in our favor. The name of the book is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Poe Bronson back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. It's always nice
Thanks
to have you here.
Joe.
What got you on this, on thinking about winning and losing?
Well, Joe, I didn't tell many people, but about 3 years ago, I had a hip replacement. I'm in my 40s. I had several unsuccessful surgeries on my leg. I was going through a lot of rehab with setbacks. It was infecting my work, my ambition, my volunteer projects. And, you know, I was kind of not feeling the same eagerness for big challenges and risks in life. And I got interested in what makes someone up for that, what makes them really willing to sort of be there and perform and get up for it. And I began to study the science of performance, which migrated into this book on the science of competition and what happens to us. I felt like I was under a lot of stress at the time. And it turns out there's a big distinction between long-term stress and short-term stress. That if you study musicians or dancers or athletes or actors or performers, they actually get just as anxious as a novice does, as an amateur does. They're stressed out about what they have to do. But it is short-term stress, and in short-term stress, your lungs dilate, your blood vessels dilate, oxygen gets into your body and is coursing through, you're tapped into your energy systems, your brain works differently, suppress fears, and you're attuned to rewards. And to compete means to take risks that are normally constrained by fear. And short-term stress can activate that. So professionals tend to see stress as beneficial to their performance, while amateurs tend to see stress as undermining their performance. And in our society, we spread this message that stress is actually bad, really bad for you. If you're stressed out about it, you're stressed out about a presentation you have to give, you're stressed out about a deadline, that's hurting you in some way and that you need to calm down. But in fact, the opposite of the case. Very often you need to go with the emotion, get emotional, get aroused, and take advantage of that different physiological state that you're in. They do these studies at Harvard of students who are studying for the graduate record exam. And on the cover page of the test booklet, it's just one line. New science says anxiety may help you with your performance. If you're feeling anxious, don't stress out. It might help you score higher today. And just that single line was driving up kids' scores by 65 points on this very, very difficult math section out of a score of 800. Learning to embrace the stress and see it as powerful is one of the key things that winners have and losers don't.
So if I'm reading you correctly, then it is in some way that stress doesn't necessarily have to, or that anxiety doesn't necessarily have to equal stress.
Well, there's a difference between stress and distress. There's a difference between challenged and being threatened. There's a difference between taxed and being overwhelmed. So, but most of us rarely actually get into that state of overwhelm. Now, there's actually a big genetic factor here in terms of how we handle stress. In a normal population, there's equally dispersed are two genes that control what goes on in the prefrontal cortex and how well it works under pressure. And half of us have one of each gene. A quarter of us have only of the type, they're called worrier genes. And a quarter of us have the warrior genes. And what's interesting is, it's good to try to identify who you might be. Because the warriors It sounds bad, but to worry is to plan. To worry is to think ahead. To worry is to like look long-term into the future, which are actually really beneficial. And actually, those with the worrier genes, when they're not under stress, they have a 10-point IQ advantage over those with the worrier genes. Actually, their brains work better. But this flip-flops under stress. Stress elevates the level of dopamine in the brain. It goes way too high. It floods like a car or gasoline, and brain function melts down. Worriers are under stress. It elevates the level of the dopamine to optimal, and their brains work wonderfully under stress. Their challenge is on a day-to-day basis, when a kid is just doing his homework, someone who's just going to work every day, kind of clocking it in, that they're actually lackadaisical, less motivated, and their brains don't work as well without stress. And so there's not one way to compete. There's many different ways. We all have to figure out what are the conditions under which we optimally compete.
When we optimally compete, what is going on? What are the ingredients?
So there's a lot of different factors that go on. Another important thing to think about is how long the competition is, how long a performance is. There's a distinction between what's called finite games, short-term competitions, and infinite games, long competitions. You know, a single performance at work can be a short-term competition, but if you're always being ranked every single week on a sales force, that can go on from 1 year to the next, or if you're a student and it's 4 years of high school or 4 years of college, we are always being compared to others. It's a very long form of competition. And so in the short-term competitions, you want to allow those emotions to come over you. You want to enjoy it and hug it out afterwards and go have a beer and forget about it. In long competitions, those who do best, and it tends to be slightly that women do better in long competitions better than men, is that you need to rest and recuperate during the competition. The ability to turn those competitive feelings off allows people to sort of recover from the stress of competing and do better long term.
When it comes to long term, that is in both success and physically, right?
Mm-hmm. Another thing that can really help people is to have a rival. You know, an interesting way to think about this is, with students, they're given a puzzles. A set of puzzles are math problems to solve, and they're told, you're competing for prizes, and there's 10 other people also who'll be doing this task today. People work really hard. Their sense of having a chance to win is decent, 1 out of 10. If you tell them there's 99 other people coming in today to do the same task, they think the odds are very poor. Anything that narrows the focus, it makes you feel like you're competing against fewer people, and having a rival is the ultimate in this, which is, so you want to beat this person, you push each other to better performance. And we see this between schools, rival schools. We see this between companies and different businesses where they have rivals. That tends to be a crucial ingredient to success.
I would assume that it also depends on the rival, doesn't it?
Well, to the definition of rival, Joe, is someone who shares a lot of things with you.
Mm.
You know, in the book, we write about not Silicon Valley, but Packaging Valley, Italy, which is near the town of Bologna. And all of the plastic clamshells that phones come in, or the blister packs that medicine comes in, not those packages, but the machine that makes those packages, most of those machines come from this tiny little region of Italy. And it's, in the last 15 years, come to dominate the world's $30 billion industry for packaging machines. And what makes it work is that they're just really right down the block. There's that sense of closeness that every year 10% of employees will trade companies or swap from one to another as they're trying to hire the best talent. They can keep tabs on their competitors. And they see themselves as very alike. You know, I want to be the best at making those cosmetics packages, you know, and I want to be the best at wrapping cheese. And so these factory workers come to work every day with a real sense of purpose, a real sense of, like, being better than the other guy that driving their productivity and their innovation and allowed them to sort of conquer this this strange little world of packaging machines.
You do make the point in the book that stars on a team do deserve special treatment. We may not all be created equal.
We have this idealized notion of teams, that everybody's equal, everybody accepts responsibility, and the teams are this nice, diverse voices. And in fact, the science says that's quite a distraction, that the best thing that makes a team function well is to really have clear roles of what different people on a team do. Teams need to be as small as possible to get the job done, so there's less complexity of things to manage. But that people need to have clear roles, and stars on a team. You know, we have this idea that it shouldn't be stars, everybody needs to be equal, but stars in a team environment, whether you're looking at physicists in academia, or you're looking at in sales environment, you're looking at NBA basketball, day in, day out, stars motivate the other people around them to get better. And stars raise the performance of all the others on a team. The difficult thing is that stars don't want to come to teams in the first place. They do studies of running job advertisements. And if you just insert the word teamwork, where the job advertisement is identical except for the word teamwork being in half of them, the quality of the applicants to the job listing that says teamwork goes way down. Stars are repelled by the notion that, because they want to stand out, they don't want to hide in the crowd. They're repelled by the notion that someone might free ride on their work, and they want to be paid for their contribution, not just averaged out over a team. So recruiting a star can be a challenge for teams. It requires making them know that with the support of the team, they're going to do better than they would alone or better in any other situation. But once you have them on a team, they often lack friends. They need friends. They need special relationships. And they are treated differently by their peers, too. So there is I in teams.
When you look at the information that you dispense in this book, Top Dog, what do you hope people ultimately get out of it that they can use in their lives to make it better?
Yeah, well, so just as I was trying to recover from this down period in my life, what I'm hoping is people get exposed, not to just one single factor, but because it's to compete is not controlled by one single variable. There's not just one trick to it. But I hope that by acclimating to these different things, reading about it, seeing how people out there are responding to challenge, it will invigorate readers just to do that, just to have some zeal for the big challenges in their life.
The name of the book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe Bronson, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it. Again, the name of the book, Top Dog, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, the authors. The book is published by 12. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.